particularly for large scale events, just day in day operations for K-12 and higher ed, we have to have a plan for getting people to shelter, a system of being able to know who we've got, who we don't have, and a process in place to be able to get folks, one, information, and two, get them back to, you know, their children or the children to their parents or legal guardian.
Welcome back to the stage, ladies and gentlemen. I'm your host, Ken Burke, and our guest today is Eric Arnold. Eric is a program director for the Illinois Law Enforcement Training and Standards Board Executive Institute at Western Illinois University. He has so much experience with emergency action plans and so much more. I can't even describe all of the things that he is knowledgeable for, but if there's anybody that knows more about student and campus safety in the world, I would be shocked because Eric has so much knowledge and all of this stuff. But Eric, thank you so much for joining me today.
No, thanks. Thanks for having me. And you just set a really high bar there. So let's lower that down just a smidge. I appreciate it. But I'm a guy just like everybody else. I put, you know, my pants on one leg at a time, and I've been through some stuff like probably a lot of your audience, you know, has been through some stuff, you know, over their careers too. So really, you know, I'm humbled to be, you know, with you, you know, and talk about this very important topic. And I can tell you that I will probably raise more questions than give answers. So, you know, there's just a lot to unpack, you know, on the topic of, you know, school safety and campus safety, and particularly when it comes to, you know, large scale, you know, events, performing arts, you know, athletic events and stuff. So we're really just all on the same mission of trying to do better, try to get this figured out so that we, you know, protect our children.
Yeah, absolutely. That's first and foremost should be our biggest concern in schools today. And yeah, we have a lot to cover today. But first of all, I wanted to ask you right off the bat, as a child, what did you want to be when you grew up, and how did you get to where you are now?
Yeah, you know, I think like most, you know, most children, you know, I'm a product of the, you know, 70s and 80s. So when you get into those formative years of, you know, when that starts kind of becoming a thing, you know, obviously, you know, I wanted to be Michael Jordan and Scottie Pippen, you know. So, you know, sports was a big part of my life. Both of my parents were very supportive, you know, of athletics, you know? So, you know, I think like most kids, you know, you had your sports, dreams, you know, out in front of you, you know, led by, you know, who was presenting in that era. So, you know, but on a life path, you know, as far as, you know, what I wanted to be. Again, that was a, you know, kind of a moving target, you know. I think once I started to get, you know, particularly kind of through the high school years, law enforcement, you know, started to kind of come, you know, into focus. I really liked the outdoors, and, you know, conservation police officers, you know, were something that, you know, were prominent, you know, in our community, just because I live in a very rural, you know, part of Illinois where, you know, everything outdoors is kind of the pastime. So I think, you know, those were one of the early things, you know, once you get past, I'm not going to be Michael Jordan, I'm not going to be Scottie Pippen, you know, it was like, you know, what are those things? So conservation police was kind of what my focus was on. And as I did pursue my athletic career into college, you know, I ran into some really cool human beings, right? Both in the social sciences and in the law enforcement realm, I think really then kind of solidified that direction of law enforcement.
Wow. Yeah. That's incredible. How did you end up where you are today? Because you did not expect to be where you're at. How did you get there?
You know, I attended Spoon River College, which is a small college here, you know, in Illinois, but, I had a significant, professor. His name was Paul North. He was a retired Chicago police officer. And I think he really kind of grabbed my attention, you know, when it came to, you know, kind of career path. And that led, you know, to me, you know, pursuing my four-year degree at Southern Illinois University. And it was just meeting, you know, high-quality human beings, right, at all those levels, right, that kind of fostered and nurtured, you know, my direction. And then that supported by a lot of really outstanding teachers and coaches, right. That really led that bedrock, right, of discipline, right, and focus and dedication and teamwork, you know, and all those things kind of all kind of came together. And no matter what profession you end up choosing, you know, all those qualities, right, are very strong, you know, qualities on top of communication and, you know, just, you know, being a kind, caring, you know, loving, you know, human being.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's very true. And, you know, as we get into our topic today of emergency action plans and what that looks like for campuses and schools all over the U.S., what is your background with developing and implementing emergency action plans? And, you know, why should people care about this stuff?
You know, so my journey is much like, you know, people that are going to be, you know, watching this podcast, all depending on what your discipline is, but I'll just focus on the law enforcement, right, is that we spent a lot of time, you know, after Columbine and our own tragedy here in Illinois, Northern Illinois University, you know, which was in that close time frame of Virginia, the tragedy at Virginia Tech, you know, we really started, focusing on our response, right? So there wasn't a whole lot of conversation about, you know, the origins of these tragedies, right? It was more focused, particularly in the first responder community, is of how do we respond? How do we physically respond, you know, to these things? So both on the police, fire, and emergency medical, it was a real kind of tactical kind of conversation, right? The Columbine, you know, if we reflect back on that, right, the old model of, you know, setting up a perimeter and waiting and all that started to change, right? And so my background, you know, really was focused on that response. How do we get there faster? How do we get in there quicker, right? How do we save lives, you know, faster? And all of this evolution, right, of tactics, right, you know, technical skills and tactics got us pretty far, right, of improving, you know, in those skill sets. But what started to reveal itself more and more, right, is that these events, these tragedies are enormous. The response is enormous, right? And if we do not have that emergency preparedness, right, really figured out before the event happens, we know that even if we have really strong technical skills, right, if we don't have the emergency operations plans, emergency preparedness, right, figured out on how all of these assets that are responding are going to come together and then effectively deploy, right, and accomplish many goals and objectives, right? Mm-hmm. The outcomes are really tragic if we don't have that. Mm-hmm. And the U.S. Department of Education and primarily FEMA, who obviously are our nation's, you know, emergency preparedness gurus, got together, right, and really had that conversation of, schools need to have emergency operations plans or crisis plans. And, you know, at face value, you kind of take that and say, okay, that makes sense. You know, we have to have a plan. But really the deeper seated, right, conversation there is that the emergency operations plans is a reflection of the quality relationships at the local level, right, and fostering their ability to collaborate with one another, right, to serve those that have been tragically, you know, impacted. So FEMA, U.S. Department of Education, you know, started cranking out these really, you know, cool documents, you know, how to develop a high-quality emergency operations plan to really kind of set us on a path of, yes, technical and tactical skills. Every discipline needs to have that, whether it's mental health service response to fire response to emergency medical to law enforcement, right, to now reunification, right? Everyone needs to have that, you know, opportunity to not build those things in silos, but put that in an emergency operations plans that is multidisciplinary and collaborative, and that has to foster the creation of healthy relationships before tragedy strikes. So that's kind of, I think, how we've kind of come, you know, over time, you know, particularly from the 90s, you know, to now, is, you know, really having to focus in on, you know, being effective and efficient at a much higher level than we always did. And we keep getting reminded, right, that we've still got a long ways to go. I mean, we only have to say a couple things. We only have to say Sandy Hook. You know, we only have to say, you know, Marjory Stoneman Douglas. You know, we only have to say, you know, for our state, you know, Highland Park, right? We only have to say Uvalde, right, to remind ourselves is that even though we've made a lot of progress, right, I think there's people doing really high-quality work out there, is that we still have to, you know, continue to strive to do better.
Mm. Yeah, and my first question off of that is, I'm sure it has changed drastically from when you first started in this profession. How have you seen that shift, especially recently? I mean, with you have social media now and the internet, and there's so many different factors playing in that now. How have you seen that shift over the years that you've been in this profession?
Yeah, well, I'll start, you know, a little bit with the shift in, you know, kind of law enforcement. We talked about the whole perimeter, right? And now our active threat response, right, is that there's no hold, right? We're going in, right? So we've seen lots of, you know, advancement, you know, kind of in that realm. We're also seeing, you know, great advancement in the police and fire and emergency medical collaboration. So not only are law enforcement going in quicker, right, in order to stop the threat, right, stop the killing, okay? Mm-hmm. But now we see that we're being much more efficient coming together and trying to get medical, you know, critical medical care, right, to those that need it. So the concept of rescue task force, you know, is one of those things that's kind of revolutionary, where before it would be, you know, the police are there, fire and emergency medical would not go in until the scene is secure. Well, that's kind of a relative term, you know, when you say secure, you know, so what we saw was extreme delays, right, of emergency medical, right, getting in to get people out and to, you know, hospitals. But we're figuring that out. So that's a huge paradigm shift, right, is that we now have this collaboration where fire understands, well, if secure means that there's no threat, right, that we're not probably going to be able to achieve that for a while. But if we can say secure means is that we have a hot zone, right, and we have a warm zone, and that with proper tactical techniques, can we assemble rescue task force, police, fire, emergency medical, right, to go into that warm zone to start rescuing people and getting them to critical care. That's happening now more and more. So that's, you know, super exciting to see happen. Things that are happening now that are huge shifts, right, is we're not just having the conversation about now the response to stop the tragedy, stop the dying, right, rescuing people, but now we're seeing huge developments, right, with evacuation, reunification, mental health services, okay? That is something that we're still, just within, you know, I'll throw out, you know, some years, you know, really solidly 3-4 years kind of, right, where we're really getting into that. And, you know, thanks to, you know, folks like the I Love You Guys Foundation, who came up with the standard, you know, reunification model, we're seeing huge advancements now in that not only are we more effective of responding, but we're also now getting into the realm of recovery, right? We're seeing some also, and I'll get real left of bang, you know, is that we're even now having huge advancements in early intervention, early warning signs. So paying attention to human behavior and people that are expressing problematic behavior or concerning behavior and getting involved in their lives and getting them off of the pathway of violence so that none of this other stuff happens, right, or is needed less. So we're always going to have to have that level of preparedness, right? But we're seeing advancements in that early intervention, early warning system, you know, as well. But for the purposes of our conversation today, you know, that real focus on what are the tactics and techniques. We talked about that rapid deployment. We talk about rescue task force. And then we also talked about reunification, right, which is, okay, do we have the emergency preparedness to start standing up systems, okay, to not only just evacuate from a location, but also get them to a safe place and get them the services that they need, right? And also get them back with, you know, their families and their loved ones and set up continuing care, you know, into the future. You know, out of our tragedy here, you know, in Illinois at Highland Park, we were able to communicate very closely with the folks from Las Vegas in the tragedy, you know, in Las Vegas. And, you know, what they told us was is that to this day, they are still providing services after that tragedy to people that were affected directly and indirectly, you know, by that event. So we're seeing huge strides being made, you know, into doing that. And I can tell you that, you know, the Highland Park tragedy in Illinois, that community came together like many communities would, right, with the assistance of federal, state, right, and local assets to serve their communities. And it wasn't that, you know, they had all that stuff figured out, you know, in advance, but they had relationships, you know, they had trusted partners that all came together, you know, to serve, you know, their community. And that work is ongoing to this day. So those are kind of the major food groups of, you know, developments, you know, going on, you know, when we talk about these emergency operations plans or crisis plans.
Is there a big difference between a school like campus, like a school shooting? And is there a difference between those and like, say like a large group at like a, you know, a theater show or a football program? What is the difference in the emergency action plan steps for that?
Yeah. So the fundamental tenets, right, of having a plan, right, that has the right people with the right relationships, right, in place are kind of universal, you know? So when we look at, you know, the emergency operations plans on any day to day for a school, that there's a thousand different reasons why we may need to, you know, evacuate a school because of a event. An active threat is just one of many. And it's actually statistically pretty low. I mean, it's much more probable that we're going to have to evacuate the school for a gas leak or a water main rupture or, you know, whatever, a roof collapse, you know, something like that, right? Chemical release, you know, whatever it may be. Right. And those fundamental building blocks, right, of having an emergency operations plan that has a core team, right, a multidisciplinary core team of folks that prior plan, okay, for what that is going to look like to get those students out of the school to a safe location are pretty universal. When we talk about, you know, your question, which was, you know, is it different than, is that plan different than, you know, what they, you know, would have for a regional football, you know, competition or a sectional football competition or state football competition? The answer to that is they're very similar. You just got to understand that the scale may be significantly larger, and it's complicated by the fact that you have a population that may be at a location, right, that is not the native population, right? They're coming from all over the place. So you have an attendance or a participant population there who may not be familiar with, you know, the location, the geography, you know, the relation, the resources, you know, that may be there, you know, to serve them. They're not at home, right? And your ability for the folks that are from that community, right, to be able to communicate with your guests that are visiting you, all of that just becomes more complex and complicated, which is kind of why we're having this conversation, is that those are the things that, you know, particularly after, you know, the tragedy in Las Vegas, a large-scale event and a tragedy where there were many people injured and or killed, you know, the amount of resources it takes, right, could be significantly larger. And we already know that for a tragedy, right, whatever that tragedy may be, on any given school day at a K-12 school or college campus is a large scale, right? It's large scale, takes a lot of resources. These special events where you've got 5, 10, 15,000 plus, right, attendees, that could be double or triple the size that school or town is used to in a normal day. So the emergency operations plans have to really be kind of elevated and escalated, right, priority-wise, just because, you know, it's going to be Everest on top of Everest for most communities. Yeah. You talk about large-scale events.
Yeah. Yeah, and, you know, you hear so much about, like, the bad situations and bad stories that come with, you know, an emergency that happens at a school, and rightly so. I mean, when injuries happen, when deaths happen, those are going to be on the news. Like that should happen because it spreads awareness. But can you share a success story about, you know, when somebody intervened or a program that helped significantly in, you know, ensuring the safety of a school campus?
Success is a relative, you know, kind of term,
right?
In most of these types of events, and I'll kind of focus on the pandemic first, right? we saw a lot of very healthy outcomes when it comes to communities coming together, you know, in that in the pandemic response, to where health departments, hospitals, first responders, K through 12 schools, institutions of higher education were all put in a pressure cooker, right, of what to do in an environment where there was very little, right, historical, right, perspective on what to do in those types of situations. You know, I mean, pandemics, most emergency preparedness on pandemics really revolved around, you know, okay, how do we get a lot of people vaccinated, right? How do we build up capacity at the hospitals to serve people that are ill? You know, COVID threw a lot of curveballs of, you know, personal protective, you know, equipment like mask and hand sanitizer and testing in the early, that no one really had, you know, a plan for that. There was a lot of adaptive planning kind of going on to do that. So I think there were successes. I mean, don't get me wrong. Most people, when they look at the pandemic, you know, they focus on a lot of failures. But I can tell you at the local level, having, you know, served, you know, in our emergency operations center for our region, is that there were a lot of really, you know, good successes, you know, kind of out of that, that because of the relationships that we had at the local level, just like, you know, in the developing a high quality emergency operations plan, did the right people to get together at the right time and start multidisciplinary decision-making process to come up with interventions and solutions. And the answer is yes, they may not have been the greatest, right, with the resources that we had at the time, but did that happen? So I use that as an example, a global kind of example of that. Now at the local level, you know, many successes. You know, I mean, whether you look at the tragedy that we had, you know, here on our campus where our emergency operations center was stood up, you know, a multidisciplinary collaboration, you know, to respond to and recover from that event, you know, from not only providing the initial shelter, you know, to students, but also, you know, crisis communication, you know, as well as coming up with alternative housing and counseling services. These are the types of successes, you know, that many tragedies, you know, have. And then we really start to get analytic on it, is that how quickly are those successes coming? Is it taking us hours or days to achieve those goals? Or because of our preparedness, are we able to kind of crush the OODA loop, right, and get those things moving and being productive in shorter amounts of time? We know that being successful in shorter amounts of time providing services to people, you know, not only saves lives, but also minimizes trauma in the long run. And then, you know, I use the example of, you know, Highland Park. You know, the first responder response, you know, to that was amazing, right? So the police and fire coming together, as well as community members, right, to rescue people and get them to critical care was phenomenal. And that speaks to that whole collaboration of police and fire with rescue task force, as well as their emergency preparedness, you know, in that community. And then we saw huge successes where the Federal Bureau of Investigation came in and assisted Highland Park, you know, with the Family Assistance Center. So in the K-12 and campus environment, think of the reunification process. There it was called a Family Assistance Center, and that provided direct service to people that were affected, thousands and thousands. So our federal partners, a huge success, you know, and gratitude to the FBI for coming in and standing that up, and then the continued support by the state of Illinois to continue those services, you know, into the future. So those are, you know, some successes.
Yeah, and you've mentioned a couple strategies that have been effective, like that collaboration, like other things that you've mentioned. What are some other strategies that you've implemented or observed, you know, for maintaining safety in an educational setting?
So some other strategies, you know, I kind of alluded to them, is that early intervention. But we're having conversations now, and particularly with our heightened state of concern, right, of, you know, global events, but also that concern of what could happen, you know, nationally, is that intelligence, right, that see something, say something, you know, is another implementation strategy, you know, that we see. So we're kind of focused on emergency operations plans in our conversation, but we see this whole, you know, very proactive, you know, implementation of, we've got to pay attention to our communities. We've got to pay attention to, you know, behaviors that are being expressed publicly, right? You know, out in the, you know, line of sight world, you know, on the street, on the sidewalk, right? In our homes, you know, in our communities. But we also have to be paying attention to the digital, right, behavior, you know, that is out there. Because like I said before, if we are paying attention to those concerning behaviors and we get involved in people's lives, right, a lot of this can be avoided. So that's that, like, far left of bang, early warning, early intervention that we really see. And who doesn't want to invest there, right? I mean, we're you know, when you talk about the amount of resources and time that we have devoted with all of these technical and tactical and emergency preparedness skills, it's super humbling, right? Because when you take the deep dive and you really at the local level start planning this out, everyone pretty much comes to the same realization real quick, right? We don't have enough people. We don't have enough resources, right? And time is not our friend, right? So it really kind of refocuses and says, what are those other initiatives that we can do, you know, so to speak, kind of upstream, right, that we could intervene so that downstream isn't so massive. So I think that early intervention, and I'll throw a term out there, it's kind of beyond our scope, right? But that whole, you know, behavioral intervention, right, team concept, or behavioral threat assessment team concept, is really something that's being embraced across the spectrum. So let me put it in perspective for, like, special events. We already know our private sector folks, you know, in some of our professional sports, you know, spend a whole heck of a lot of time pre-event, not only planning for what could go wrong, right, but also paying attention to what is out there behavior-wise, what's being expressed out there behavior-wise, you know, as well. So you think of big, you know, the World Cup, right, the football championships, you know, basketball championships. The level of preparedness, right, and paying attention to what's going on in those communities prior to that event is something that is getting folded into, you know, the emergency operations, you know, of any event. Is it that intelligence branch, right, can be that group of folks that's paying attention to the vibe, right, of what's going on. So if there's someone out there that's having an issue with that event or that person, right, or a person involved with that event, can we take a much more proactive approach to engaging them, right, so that we can avoid tragedy? So that's probably one of the most significant. We're talking about emergency operations plans and reunification and all that kind of stuff, but it's like there's a whole other realm of proactiveness. So when I have conversations with, you know, my K-12 schools and institutions of higher education, not only on a day-to-day operations, but for special events, is that, yeah, we need to stand up our incident command, our emergency operations center, right, just on an intelligence level to be paying attention so that when someone does see something and they do say something, that it's heard, right, and a plan of an appropriate intervention, right, is come up with. I mean, how many times, right, do we have to have examples, tragic examples of everybody knew? Everybody knew. There was information out there. There were things being said. There was behaviors being demonstrated, right, that seemingly didn't get into the hands or the ears, right, and the minds of the right people to intervene, and tragedy then ensued. So we always have a lot of regret out of every tragedy, you know, in that, particularly at the local level, is that, you know, once we start finding out that there was a ton of information out there, and the gravity of all that sets in, that's a tough one that impacts you, you know, deeply at the local level, that, man, could we have done more? You know, could we have been paying attention more? And we're at a critical time right now where, I mean, you can see it all in the headlines, right? Everyone is saying, if you see something, say something, report that to. And then the conversation comes back to you, okay, I see it. Okay, I'm willing to say it. Who do I say it to? Is anybody telling me who to say, report that information to, outside of, you know, the traditional, what you would think would be logic for people is that, well, probably the police, you know, that kind of makes sense. But are there others that this information need to be reported to as well? And the answer is yes, it should be. Law enforcement's a great, you know, first step.
Yeah. Yeah. That goes back to, you know, social media and how that plays in so many different ways, I'm sure, when it comes to, you know, emergencies and stuff like that, and being prepared for that and being proactive. Yeah, what initial steps Now that we've covered all this ground, what initial steps can administrators or, you know, state association employees, what did they need to do to ensure safety on campus or take proactive steps in order to ensure that?
Yeah, I mean, that first step, you know, really is there has to be a prioritization, right, of getting together, right? I mean, it's that old adage, get around the kitchen table, right? And start having that conversation. And the conversation really needs to, I think it's very healthy. It's not the only way, it's just a way, you know, is to really sit down and talk about, okay, what resources do we have? Or more importantly, what resources do we not have, in place? I think that's a really good starting place, you know, to sit down once you get the right people. So police, fire, emergency medical, you know, your hospital, you need to involve your hospitals, your various, internal institutions within your school or college, right? And that will have a role in any type of emergency, you know, response, your counseling center, right? And everyone really just having that healthy conversation of what are the assets that we have, right? And really, you know, do that gap analysis, right? Or have a realistic, right, expectation of, well, maybe we don't have everything that we need. And are there ways that we can get what we need in time of crisis? And I can tell you from a mutual aid standpoint, particularly with the police, fire, emergency medical, and hospitals, most of those systems, right, are already established about how to get more resources. It's really an understanding of, yeah, we may have limited in the initial stages, right, but very quickly, right, there's going to be an enormous amount of resources, right, and that has all evolved, you know, since 9/11 with mutual aid response. And it's not just law enforcement mutual aid. It's fire mutual aid. It's emergency medical. It's hospital mutual aid. It is now mental health resource mutual aid. That's a real conversation that's going on now. So starting that meeting, right, and getting together and having that conversation, right, of what you have. Now, not getting hung up there, right, because it's very easy to get hung up there. It's like, well, we can't do anything because we don't have anything. It's real easy to hitch there. You want to know what's realistic, right? What you're working with in the initial stages. But then that conversation needs to evolve into, okay, what are, right, for any emergency preparedness, whether it's an event or just general, right, what are the various threats and hazards that we need to consider for the resources that we have, right? So having that conversation about, okay, we'll leave active threat a little bit. What if we do have that grain mill, right, that explodes or catches on fire that's two blocks away, you know, from the school? What are we going to need to do for that event? What are we going to do with the train derailment where the train tracks are within a close proximity to a special event or a school or campus? What are we going to do with that, right? A truck rollover with hazardous materials, same thing with trains, right? Grain mills. Gas pipe leaks, right? We got a lot of gas, we've got a lot of pipelines carrying a very assortment of stuff across just about every jurisdiction, right? So it's really doing that threat analysis, right, of what are the things that we can anticipate for our community and or an event, you know, that we need to have a specific plan in place to address that. Who do we call? How do we respond, you know, for that? Those are the things, you know, in those initial conversations of building a high-quality emergency operations plan that we need to have in place. And once we've identified those threats and hazards, right, then it's really coming up with, I'll just call them an action plan, right, or what are those objectives, goals and objectives for each one of those specialty type of scenarios that may happen. Because once you start getting surgical, you know, and you get a plan that, hey, we know what we need to do with a train derailment. We know what we need to do and what needs to be set in place for a grain mill exploding or a gas leak or a water main. Once you start getting those specific responses, we used to call them annexes. Well, we still do call them annexes for those specific types of threats and hazards. We start learning very quickly that there's a lot of commonality of response in all of those specialty events, right? And this becomes kind of a rinse and repeat kind of scenario. It's like, oh, we built that out for the train derailment. Guess what? That plan also works for the grain mill, you know, exploding, or they're similar, right? Which may be somewhat similar to, you know, when a pipeline, but knowing, you know, the locations of gas shutoffs and water main shutoffs and all those types of things has to be predetermined in a plan and then practiced. So that's kind of what that initial, you know, planning, you know, kind of looks like. And then your special events, right? Your large scale, you know, special events, like we've kind of, said before, these are specialty events that have other dynamics, right? We talked about that, other visitors coming from other jurisdictions, that, you know, have to have a more robust conversation, you know, because you may already have an extremely large population of people in an area. And I'll just give this example, and I sometimes get in trouble with this example, but, you know, a large scale sporting event that may have thousands of people and there's one ambulance there, right? Okay. There's no medical triage, you know, kind of things. Now, I'm in full support of there being an ambulance there, right? But in a mass injury, mass casualty type of event, right, do we need to have more, knowing that we're already in a very large environment of attendees? Now, that's where I get myself in trouble, because they're like, well, what are you suggesting, Eric, that we have 100 ambulances? You know, and it's no. But do we have a plan, right? Do we have a plan, and do we have the relationships in place that in a very short amount of time, right, we are going to have many more ambulances there, and that's assured. But that plan is explicit, that the mechanism is there, that if we need 100 ambulances, that's too high of a number in most jurisdictions, right, unless you're a major metropolitan. But if we need 10 ambulances, right, that we have a pretty good idea how long it's going to take to get those 10 ambulances there. And more importantly is, do we have the capability, knowing that that's going to take a little bit, do we have the on-site capability, particularly those, you know, that are critically injured, to stop the bleed, right? Do we have, for that size of an audience, a decent capacity, right, of things like tourniquets and pressure dressings, right, that buy people time until those ambulances can get there, the helicopters can get there to get them to critical care. Those are all those, you know, things that we need to have in those conversations about large scale events. And then the reunification, right? You know, that part, more and more, we are knowing that, you know, particularly for large scale events, just day in day operations for K-12 and higher ed, we have to have a plan for getting people to shelter or a collection point, right? A system of being able to know who we've got, right, who we don't have, and a process in place to be able to get folks, one, information, and two, get them back to, you know, their children or the children to their parents or legal guardian. Mm-hmm. Most of these emergency operations plans that I see for particularly large-scale events sometimes don't have anything built out for that. They basically take this approach. Well, there's thousands of people. We don't stand a chance of really knowing who we have and who we don't have. So they're just kind of on their own. And I'm not in disagreement that that's reality, right? That's reality. But do we know now, right, with standard reunification practices, that for a large scale event, should we have the ability to have a conversation about every school district or participating school that is at an event, you know, has to have a record, an accountability record of who is at that event, emergency contacts. And the answer to that is, for a lot of these events, they absolutely do that. That in their pre-prior planning, that, hey, school district A, you need to have a roster of all your participants, right, all of their emergency contacts and all that. Where it gets a little bit dicey, right, is, okay, well, you have all of that. Where are you going to send those folks? Are you going to be able to even get them out of that community, right? Are you going to be able to transport them out? And I can tell you who's going to be coming to that community. All of their parents mm-hmm. that are not attending that event and their family members are now going to be coming to your town. How are you going to handle that volume? I mean, it's one thing to handle the volume of all the first responders coming. Now you've got kids that may have come all the way across the state, right, to a location. Their parents are not with them. And when they get that notification that bad thing has happened at this event, I can assure you they are coming to you. And if you do not have an event plan to say, all of you who are coming to our location, do not come to the affected area, go to this reunification site. That has to be a conversation that is had, you know, for not only our K through 12 schools and institutions of higher education on an average day, but for large scale special events for sure. And that's tough. I mean, I when I say that, I know there's going to be a lot of people that listen to that and say, what did that guy just say? You know, did he just say that we need to have a reunification plan, you know, for our March Madness event for, you know, high school, you know, basketball, and there should be a plan in place to, you know, get people to a safe area and then a strategy about how to get them reunited and services provided for the trauma that they may have experienced, so that we, and the answer more and more is absolutely we do. And that's tough. I'm really unpopular when I have that conversation, because it's a big ask. It's a big ask. And I don't take that lightly. I don't throw that out there lightly. But we have to start making strides to that.
Yeah. Yeah, that is, I mean, that's really heavy stuff. And, you know, it's reality. It's a reality these days. And I think that's good that, you know, you express that and are honest as well. But, you know, Eric, thank you so much for the time today. This has been awesome, just an awesome experience for myself. And is there any last thoughts you have, or any encouragement that you want to leave the audience with?
Yeah, absolutely. I would encourage everyone, you know, this is a plug for, you know, our federal partners, but if someone's saying crisis plan and emergency operation plan is foreign, you know, or if you just wanted to go out and self-educate, you know, yourself, you know, on this, I would highly encourage you to go out to the U.S. Department of Education's REMSTA, that's REMSTA Center. They have a lot of these resources available to us for free. So if you wanted to, you know, see the standard process for developing a emergency operations plan, if you wanted free software, right, to download, right, for a template to start plugging your school district or campus, you know, into a software, all of those resources are out there at the REMSTA, the U.S. Department of Education REMSTA, and that was done in collaboration with FEMA. The other is, I would, you know, and this is another, you know, one that people are like, are you sure you want to say that? I would encourage you to go out to the Federal Emergency Management Agency and really research the ICS or Incident Command resources that FEMA has available. One of the things I really run into at the local level is people don't have a strong understanding, right, of that structure that in a massive response to a crisis, right, that structure of how they operate that, how they actually make that work. So all my K through 12 schools and institutions of higher education, we say you really need to go out and take, you know, some of the fundamental courses by FEMA, you know, Incident Command 100, 200, 700, and 800, to get a feel for when these, you know, state, county, local county, and state agencies come to help you, it's going to look a certain way. For most of my local folks, right, particularly school districts, right, they don't know how to speak that language, and sometimes they really feel like they don't know how to plug themselves in to that process. And quite frankly, sometimes the first responder community doesn't know how to plug them in, because it's like trying to, you know, teach someone to run when they don't know how to even crawl yet. So going out there and researching that on the FEMA website has value. There are free online courses that you can take. There's all kinds of literature, you know, as well. But those are those foundational building block kind of things. Now, what we're talking about with, you know, large scale events and stuff like that, I can tell you that it's a bit of it in its infancy, you know, just because of the enormity of that. Most of the time, we're really struggling at the local level to be able to pull this off, you know, for our K through 12 schools and institutions of higher education on any day. Stepping into now the arena of special large scale events, whether that be performing arts or more of your sports, you know, types of events, that's pretty intimidating, you know. But if you got to start somewhere,
those would be the places that I would go, you know, and say that. And the good news is, particularly for my performing arts folks, you know, whether that and athletics, right, is they are really good at pulling off really, really nice experiences at their events. When I think of all of the large scale state tournaments, regional tournaments, sectional tournament, super sectional kind of stuff, organizationally, they've got mad skills. Because, I mean, decade after decade after decade, right, they have really nice events. They can translate those skills of that passion into emergency preparedness very nicely if they know the language to speak. So those are just some examples of some resources that I'd encourage people to do.
Yeah, and we'll definitely put the links in the description for that for sure, for all those resources. But Eric, thank you so much for coming on today. This was really a treat.
Appreciate it, Ken. Thank you so much.
All right, well, for all of our listeners out there, please remember to subscribe to the show and share it with someone that you think will be impacted by what was discussed today. Thanks so much for listening, and I hope to catch you next time on The Stage.